The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Riley, Judge Sleater, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Bryan presiding. Our first case is A20-1599, Stacy Ann Rackow, petitioner appellant versus Ryan Frank Prezilba, respondent.
Good morning, and thank you for participating in these remote arguments. Even though we're not in person, the same rules will apply to the arguments this morning. We understand that from time to time, there will be interruptions. We will try to do our best to keep them to a minimum. If for any reason somebody freezes or drops off, we will stop the clock and make sure you each have the full time allotted to make your arguments to this court. Please also remember that the proceedings are being audio recorded. So before you begin speaking, state your name and the party that you represent. This is also why you should remember to mute your microphones when not presenting an argument. And last, we require that all parties and participants refrain from making any of their own recordings of these proceedings. And with that, counsel, are you ready to proceed? Counsel for appellant, I should say, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, you may begin. Go ahead if you would state your name.
Thank you, Your Honor. Edward Irishaw, representing appellant. And this matter concerns an initial custody determination and it was a post-trial motion, and then this appeal followed afterwards. And this is a somewhat unusual case. For the most part, appellant is not challenging the trial court's findings of fact. Those findings of fact were generally, I think, accurate and reflected the evidence, with a couple exceptions noted in our memorandum. Our concern is that the conclusions of law and order simply did not match with the findings of fact, were not consistent with those findings. And we also have a concern that the trial court incorrectly applied a modification standard when this is an initial custody determination. I don't think there's any doubt or dispute this was an initial determination. The matter was pending for some time. There had been a motion hearing, there had been a temporary custody order, but this was the initial custody determination in the dissolution, and the trial court referred to a modification standard as opposed to an initial determination standard. I believe that that point is essentially moot, as even if a modification standard were applied, there certainly would be endangerment, but it is important to apply the initial determination standard. And in the trial court's findings of fact, the court made a number of specific findings concerning very concerning behavior on the part of respondent. The court referred to respondent being in a high-speed chase with one of the minor children in the car, fleeing law enforcement. Yeah, he was driving late at night, had picked up one of the minor children from apparently his parents' house and rolled through a stop sign, and then a police officer activated his lights and siren to pull respondent over. Respondent accelerated, attempted to flee the officer. Trial court found the respondent drove at a high rate of speed with the minor child in the car, apparently pulled into a yard, stopped the vehicle quickly, got out and ran. There was a foot pursuit attempt by law enforcement. Respondent evaded law enforcement. And trial court also found that respondent likely did that so law enforcement would not know that he had been drinking, as he had not turned himself into law enforcement until a couple days later. And
Mr. Shaw, can I, sorry to interrupt you. I just wanted to clarify a question following your preliminary comments. Would you agree? I think the remedy you're requesting is reverse, but would you agree if the standard is wrongly applied, we would need to remand, meaning the best interests, for the court to then satisfy that standard. So for additional findings so that it's reviewable for our court, which it's not, from your client's standpoint, not right now because the wrong standard wouldn't apply or does apply. And we would disregard the alternative endangerment and simply remand for best interest findings. Does that sound accurate?
Thank you, Your Honor. And I think it does sound accurate. And certainly if there was to be a review based on the best interest standard, there would need to be findings consistent with the best interest standard. But I would suggest an alternative remedy that even if the endangerment standard were applied, that respondent's conduct clearly endangers the minor children. So I think even if that's, to avoid the time involved in a remand, an additional fine, it's a lengthy process and there are minor children involved. So I think even if the endangerment standard were applied, respondent's conduct clearly endangered the minor children, even if that standard were applied, Your Honor.
Mr. Shaw, if I could ask a follow-up then, because it seemed to me that the parenting time schedule that your client had hoped for would also be something that would be out of the ordinary, let's say, if a court were to find that this incident regarding the high-speed chase was something that endangered the children or caused the court so much concern that they were able to make some endangerment finding on that basis or on some basis about alcoholism, wouldn't that also be inconsistent with the parenting time schedule that your client was hoping the court would adopt? In other words, the custody evaluator had one parenting time schedule for the school year and one for the summer, and I believe your client was asking the court to adopt the academic year schedule year round, which would have provided father with 5 of every 14 overnights. So that's where I have my question, as you're making this argument that the high-speed chase somehow required or compelled a conclusion regarding the father endangering the children when your client was simultaneously asking for father to have 5 of every 14 overnights.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that's a good point. And we believe that the schedule recommended by the custody evaluator year round, which was requested by appellant, with conditions of respondent maintaining sobriety and with some fairly strict conditions, only operating a vehicle with ignition or lock in place. We think with those conditions that schedule, which is certainly time with respondent, but less than half time, would be able to meet the safety needs of the children. That's a very good point the court brings up. I think that would be able to meet the safety needs with some fairly strict conditions enforced by the trial court. Obviously, if respondent had continuing behaviors of this nature, issues came up in this criminal case, violations of probation would need to be looked at again, but we think that reduced schedule would meet the safety needs of the child with the conditions that the custody evaluator recommended and that we requested as well.
When I looked at the record, there was the initial separation and custody determination that the parties agreed to. And then after the high-speed chase, we'll call it, there was a stipulation that modified that by putting some interlock conditions and other things like that, but did not change the schedule. And it seems that maybe the district court was persuaded or took that into account that your client agreed to continue the schedule as it had been with those modifications without asking for more time like she is now. It's all speculation, but do you have any response to that observation?
Well, I mean, that certainly is a good point. And I agree that it is speculation because there weren't findings to that effect. The findings did not, there aren't any findings that support that. But I would agree that certainly was a possible consideration. And I would respond that after that temporary stipulation was made, that one, there were continuing behaviors on the part of respondent that caused concern. And more important, the trial was, I think there was an expectation of parties, the trial would be coming on fairly soon. Obviously, COVID intervened, a lot of other things happened. The trial was delayed considerably. A lot of that was due to the pandemic. I mean, things just happened. It wasn't the fault of any of the parties in the court, but I think there was an understanding there would be a trial soon after. The custody evaluator would finish her report. I don't think anybody at the time that stipulation was made assumed that it would be more than a year before the matter came on for trial. And again, those were circumstances that nobody could have foreseen or controlled. And I certainly agree that there were also weren't findings made to support that sort of a conclusion, but it's possible that was part of the thought process. I mean, the findings are generally, quite detailed and concerning about the behavior of respondent, not just the high-speed chase, but denying an alcohol issue, a serious drinking problem in a state of denial about it, which is obviously very concerning, making no efforts to address it. And the trial court also found the custody evaluator in finding of fact number 7 did a detailed report, thorough report. Trial court didn't make any findings that the custody evaluator is deficient in any way, that the report was substandard or incomplete in some way or another. Obviously, a trial court is not bound to follow the recommendation of a custody evaluator or a guardian, but if they're not going to follow that recommendation, it's appropriate to make findings explaining why.
Mr. Shaw, if I can jump in here, because I'm looking at the the order at the that's attached in the addendum. In the order section, you've got these paragraphs that are incorporating other orders, including the stipulation from January 6th, 2020, as well as the custody evaluation report. There are additional recommendations that it says, which are not inconsistent, shall be incorporated. And I thought I heard you earlier saying that your argument was that the conditions, for example, the interlock condition, was not something the district court adopted. So let me clarify to make sure I'm understanding your argument correctly. Are you saying that the district court did not impose that condition on father's parenting time? Or do you agree that these paragraphs in the order section of the decree do incorporate those conditions? Because I'm looking at the stipulation from January 20, and it's right there about interlock. And if that was incorporated at paragraph 3 of the order, then wouldn't that be a condition?
Oh, it certainly was. And if I gave the impression it wasn't, my apologies, those conditions were incorporated. The district court did not follow the schedule recommended by the evaluator, but the district court did incorporate some of the evaluator's recommendations, including continued use of ignition interlock. So that was incorporated, no doubt there, and certainly.
So how does that square with your argument earlier that you're asking this court to conclude that the children are endangered when they're with father under these conditions that were ordered?
Well, our concern is that with the children being with the father half the time, that, you know, that amount of time, that if looking at, you know, that respondent has a drinking problem, I don't think anybody can doubt that. The high speed chase and other testimony and findings made by the trial court, you know, if one has one's children for a limited amount of time, it's more possible to not be drinking during those more limited periods of time, half the time, you know, a week at a time.
But isn't the alternative that you were arguing for, or that your client wanted, was 5 of every 14 overnights, and the court imposes a schedule that allows 7? So we're talking about 5 versus 7, and you're saying that at 5 they're not endangered with those conditions, but at 7 they would be endangered under those conditions?
I mean, it's a, like a lot of things, it's a matter of degree, that the more time in a 2-week period, the harder it is to remain sober during that time, Your Honor. And I mean, there is a cutoff at some point, and obviously one can go all the way to the point of saying, you know, father can't have any time at all, supervision center only. That's an extreme and restrictive remedy, and that's not something that appellant was asking for at the trial.
Mr. Shaw, how do you respond to the respondent's argument that when you read the judge's order, the judge certainly talks about best interests along with endangerment, and then incorporates things like the custody evaluation, which did a thorough analysis of the best interest factors? And so as I read a respondent's brief, she argues that the judge did make those best interest factors, maybe not in the way that most of us are used to seeing them. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, the court did make some references to the custody evaluation report. That's, you know, certainly correct. But I would look at, you know, finding of fact number 20, specifically, there has not been any endangerment alleged or allegations of chronic failure complying with parenting time. Both of those findings I would respectfully submit are not correct, but they also certainly reflect the modification standard. Those are the standards looked at in a modification, not an initial determination. So the trial court's own words suggest the trial court was looking at this as a modification, not an initial determination. I'm just going by what the trial court said in its own findings, Your Honor.
Mr. Shaw, can I ask, you raised an issue regarding the post-trial motion, and I'm having a bit of a hard time understanding what the legal basis might be that we would find error, but perhaps more importantly, am I correct that it essentially was a post-trial motion now seeking restriction of parenting time that I'm assuming that the court had issued its order about approximately 9 days, if I understand correctly, before the motion was filed with the court. was there allegations that your client had made from the time of trial to the time of that motion that had newly arisen that the court had orally denied then on the record?
Yes, that's that also responds to Judge Bryan's point that the initial post-trial motion was filed before the decision came out based on a respondent violating the conditions of transporting the children in a vehicle that does not have ignition interlock and reports that he had been drinking around the children in the vehicle. That was the basis of the initial post-trial motion. The motion was amended after the court's order came out, and the post-trial hearing was after the court order came out, but the initial motion was before the order came out, and it was based on circumstances that occurred after the trial. And based on those circumstances, which showed continuing concerning behaviors by respondent, appellant was asking for a more restrictive parenting time schedule than the 5 days was asked for at trial. So we were asking for less time based on continuing behaviors, not complying with the conditions in the temporary order, which were subsequently incorporated into the permanent order. So there, we were asking for a different schedule on the post-trial motion, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shaw, and you will have some time for rebuttal to follow up on the arguments and questions that you've made so far, as well as the arguments of Ms. Stanislavski. Ms. Stanislavski, are you prepared to proceed?
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christy Stanislavski. I do represent the respondent, Ryan Prisbilla, in this matter. I will first go to endangerment. I just want to clarify a few things there. I agree with some of the court's questioning in regards to what actually happened after this, if we call it the high-speed chase or the incident that occurred in November of 2019. In the days or weeks that followed, the appellant in this matter voluntarily agreed to allow the children to remain with the respondent so long as he had the interlock system attached to his vehicle and he only transported the children with that vehicle. And he agreed not to consume alcohol while he was having parenting time. She voluntarily agreed to that. And now we're talking, you know, a year, little over a year later, she's saying that that is endangerment. That because of that one incident that occurred, back in November of 2019, that rises to the level of endangerment. And this court erred, or the trial court erred, by not finding that that is endangerment. But you have the fact that she didn't believe it was endangerment. She still believed that the children should be there 50% of the time with respondent. You also had a custody evaluator who did an extensive job with the initial custody evaluation, and then the court had her do another investigation following this high-speed incident, and she didn't change any of her recommendations either, and she never mentioned anything about needing supervised parenting time or anything of that nature. And so I think the fact that this judge, the trial court judge, did not find endangerment with this one isolated incident just reaffirms exactly what everybody else has done, that the appellant didn't think it was endangerment, the custody evaluator didn't think it rose to the level of endangerment. And we hear a lot about, we saw it in the brief, we hear it even in oral arguments today, that the continuing behaviors after the agreement was reached and entered into order in January of 2020, none of those continuing behaviors that we hear about were ever presented at trial. Everything that was presented at trial was before this incident, and then a lot of time was spent on the November 2019 incident. But there was no other incidents that were brought up through evidence, through testimony or exhibits or anything of that nature at trial. So we hear a lot about the respondent's drinking problems. We hear a lot about his continuing behaviors that are concerning, but there is no other allegations of anything that has occurred. They brought up some information following the trial that was eventually heard at the November 20th hearing of 2020, but that was well after the trial. That was not before the trial. And again, just because the court didn't find that those rose to the level of endangerment, that that motion hearing, it's also possible that the court just didn't believe they were credible. At that motion hearing, they brought a picture of him, my client, driving a vehicle, or it wasn't even a my client, a car that looked like my client's car, and they're claiming it didn't have the interlock. But there's no indication that my client was even driving that vehicle or it was his vehicle. There was no testimony to that, or there was no evidence that was presented to that.
Ms. Stanislavski, while you're talking about the motion hearing, I wanted to ask a clarifying question about what you think has been appealed about that, because there were two sets of motions. The first motion had five parts, and the second one, 14 days later, so the first one on October 16 had five parts to it. And then on October 30th, about, 9 days after the district court's decree, there's another motion that includes those exact same five parts, but then adds some additional five more, including a motion for contempt, a motion regarding location of exchanges, the time of exchanges, the holiday schedule change, and requesting to play a video at this hearing. So as I look at the briefs, I'm trying to make sure I understand what has been appealed from those, and now it's 10 motions. And I don't see any arguments regarding the denial of the contempt motion. And so I'm not sure that's before us. Would you agree that the contempt motion was not, there was no error assigned or identified regarding the denial of that contempt motion?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I am a little perplexed, I guess, with the regards to what is being appealed regard that motion hearing as well. As I read the transcript, because the court did it orally, he did not issue a written order. But as I read that the transcript, it is my understanding that he extensively went through the testimony of the counselor for one of the minor children, and he made findings as to the parenting time for that minor child. He also made it very clear that he was sick and tired, basically, of these motions being brought by the appellant, and basically said he's going to start entertaining attorney fees if that's the case. As I read the appellant's brief regarding what they're appealing with regards to that motion hearing, it's my understanding that they just didn't simply like the fact that he didn't issue written findings or make more extensive findings regarding their concerns. But as I read, or as I, you know, review the trial transcript, I don't believe that that there are any issues that are still outstanding, and simply that the appellant is just trying to, I guess, get this court to, and it was an initial question, reverse the decision versus remanding it. I think she's trying to find a court that is going to give her what she wants versus just going back to that trial court to make further findings, if that's the case. But I don't believe that any of those issues were not addressed by the court with regards to any of those issues raised in the motion at that motion hearing. I believe that he had lumped them together, but I don't believe that he had any sort of duty to make specific findings to each and every issue raised by the appellate at that motion hearing.
But do you think that the court made, because I'm looking at the transcript now, page 29 of the transcript from the motion hearing. This is really the only time that the court speaks, and it's from lines 9 through 20. So 11 lines out of a 30-page transcript where the court is looking at or talking about the motions and talking about its ruling, there really aren't any findings that I can discern from those 11 lines regarding any of the motions. So I want to make sure, because I think you said that at the transcript, you interpret the court's comments as findings, but maybe I'm looking at the wrong page, or maybe there's some other aspect that you're referring to that I'm missing, because all I see are these 11 lines.
Your Honor, and what I refer to is, yes, I believe it's about 11 lines. And in his initial comments are regarding the minor child, because there was testimony by the counselor at this hearing, and that was requested by appellant. There was testimony by the counselor and he heard that testimony. So he's talking a little bit about that testimony, but then he does specifically state the court is not finding that there's any inference by the father regarding the parenting time of the mother. And so that's the finding that I am referencing initially. Again, I don't know if it's necessarily a finding, but I think it's very informative in terms of where his thought process was at when the next sentence he says is, I will inform if this comes again, I will entertain an attorney fee request. This is just something that simply has to stop.
So to the extent that these post-trial motions, and I'm talking now about the second set, because I think that supersedes the first, since it repeats the same motions in the identical language. So now you have motions being made post-decree. And so to the extent that is the right way to characterize these motions, is there any authority that you can point us to that would permit a court to deny post-decree modification motions without making findings, written findings, without analyzing what you would expect to see in a post-trial modification motion? There's lots of cases that set forth what that standard looks like. It's not just endangerment. You also have change in circumstances, which is, I think, what Judge Slita was referring to at the outset. So there are other aspects to every consideration of every modification of custody and parenting time motion. Is there some authority you can point us to that would permit a court to address those kinds of motions in the way the district court did here?
I don't have the authority in front of me. What I would say to the court is my understanding of those motions at the time, and it's speculation, but presumably perhaps the judge felt the same way, was that it was the motion initially started as an ex parte motion. Appellate was looking to have my client have his time be suspended or supervised, I should say, and very limited, extremely limited, because of this one incident that they were raising with the court. It started as an ex parte motion. In just a few days after that ex parte motion was filed, we then got this trial court order. And so we knew a little bit more, obviously, of where the court was going. And so from there, I never took these motions by appellate to be post-trial motions where now she was asking the court to make new findings regarding the motions. To me, it still all seemed to hinge on that ex parte motion. It's just now that the court had set a new motion date, which was not until, I believe, November, that then there was more time. And so the things that she didn't like about the order, such as the exchange locations or the vacation times, those types of things, holiday times, it seemed to me not to be so much post-trial motions, and I don't think it was ever phrased that way or deemed that way. It was just an expansion of their ex parte motion in terms of now we have these new issues and we were asking the court on an ex parte basis to suspend his time and presumably then get into even a Niece Peterson standard or something of that nature. And so that's how I perceived it. I don't know if that's how the court perceived it either, but when I started to see references to post-trial motions, I was even a little bit confused because that's not how it was ever deemed. That's not how it was ever presented to the court to the best of my understanding. And so I just viewed it more as an expansion of the ex parte motion that was being presented to the court.
Ms. Stanislawski, can I take you back to the original trial order itself? You noted in your brief that both parties submitted proposed findings with proposed best interest analysis. And as you point out, and we're talking about the court rejected that from both proposed orders because there's no specific best interest findings. But I believe both counsel cited the Rosenfeld case that the court must consider and provide its analysis of the best interest findings. Now, you make reference to the and we've talked about it here, the court incorporated in its order portion of the order, the custody evaluator. Are you aware of, which includes best interest, her best interest analysis, are you aware of any authority that would suggest to us that satisfy Rosenfeld? Because it strikes me that means the judge is not doing his own analysis, but doing her, or accepting her analysis, but not its analysis, which Rosenfeld requires.
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that in addition to Rosenfeld, he has a duty. Let me think about how to say this. The court not only looked at what the custody evaluator has written. She went through, obviously, the best interest factors. Counsel and I both went through the best interest factors. The court heard testimony at trial regarding what the best interest factors were, evidence through the parties and through the witnesses. And then, obviously, there were exhibits as well. The record supports that the court found the evaluator's recommendations, to some extent, were worth adopting. You know, and as a court referenced earlier, he puts that in his record. He's adopting everything that's not inconsistent. He's adopting the recommendations. But I think the fact that he took it upon himself to determine that the fact that petitioner has not shown that the current conditions warrant further restriction of the respondent's parenting time, that neither party has shown that there is any home environment dangers or anything of that nature, to me says that he looked at what the custody evaluator was recommending and took it a step further and used his own independent judgment and believed that what he heard through the testimony outweighed what the custody evaluator was recommending. And that's why, Your Honor, I believe that he didn't just adopt, but he took into consideration what the testimony and the evidence showed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shaw. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Going back to the point about the custody evaluator, and in a situation where a trial court was adopting all of the recommendations of the custody evaluator, that report could be incorporated into findings if the court, you know, clearly incorporates it by reference. But in this case, the trial court did not follow the most important recommendation of the custody evaluator, the parenting time schedule. The trial court found the custody evaluator made a detailed and thorough report, didn't find any flaws in the custody evaluator report, didn't criticize the report or the foundation of it or the reasoning, but then did not follow the most important part of the court and simply never told us why. I mean, we shouldn't have to guess at what the trial court's thinking, and the whole purpose of detailed findings and Rutanen and all the other cases that call for that is so everybody knows, right or wrong, you know where the trial court's coming from. And here we have to guess, well, maybe the court thought this, maybe the court thought that, because the findings simply didn't match up with the order, and the post-trial motion was virtually, even orally, there were almost no findings, just a few lines from the transcript. One can't tell how the trial court considered those post-trial motions, even if they were considered to any extent. There's no record on that. And, you know, looking at the court's own findings, this wasn't an isolated incident of a one-off incident. And it certainly is the high-speed chase is a very serious incident that would sow endangerment all by itself. I mean, the trial court's own findings that, you know, he respondent, you know, speeded up to over 70 miles an hour in a 35 mile an hour zone with the minor child in his car, that he had when the officer got to the vehicle after respondent fled, leaving his son in the vehicle, there was an odor of alcoholic beverage. Respondent claimed that might have been fluorine chemicals. The trial court found that was not credible. I mean, the trial court made detailed findings that respondent had a serious problem with alcohol abuse, summed up in the bottom of finding of fact number 14. And the court believes the facts surrounding the November 2019 incident lead to the conclusion that respondent does have issues involving alcohol that are unaddressed and concerning as they relate to the best interests of the children. The findings on that were detailed. And I should note, the trial court also found that respondent denied petitioner parenting time with one of the minor children with no reasonable explanation as well. I mean, the findings were detailed and do not support the conclusion that, you know, just have an equal parenting time schedule contradictory to the report recommendation of the custody evaluator and of the trial court's own findings. And I would certainly agree with the court that findings should have been made on the post-hearing motions. It appears the trial court did not make those findings, and again, we're left to guess as to what the reasoning was. But evidence was submitted that respondents' concerning behaviors of alcohol were continuing. He was driving in a vehicle not of ignition interlock. Kids reported he'd been, drinking in their presence, that there was a pattern that was going on before the high-speed chase and after, and that.
Shaw, before you run out of time, I wanted to ask you the same question regarding the post-trial or post-decree motions. I don't see you in the brief identifying any error regarding denial of the contempt motion, regarding the denial of the attorney fees motion, regarding anything about the time of or location of exchanges, regarding the holiday schedule, or playing a video. What I think you argue, though, is that there was some error in the district court's decisions to deny the request for temporary indefinite emergency supervision, the request for a chemical dependency assessment, and the prohibition on transporting children. Those, to me, look like the motions that you think were decided erroneously. Would you agree with that, or do you think that you were also identifying error in the way the district court considered or ruled on the contempt motion, the request regarding exchanges, et cetera?
I would agree with the court's characterization. Those are the issues the court identified are the key issues. The other issues are peripheral, and courts have broad discretion on the other issues, the contempt motion, attorney's fees, et cetera. Those aren't the main issues. Those aren't the main concern. The court has identified the main issues in the post-trial motion. That's correct, and thank you for clarifying. And thank you, Your Honor, counsel. Take care.
Thank you both for your arguments and your briefs. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.